Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Hagman Report for Monday, March 2nd, 2020. Doug Hagman is off today. He'll be back tomorrow. And I'm Peter Barry-Chalka. I'll be guest hosting the entire two-hour program today. And as a lot of you know from my many appearances here, including my guest hosting last Monday, February 24th, I'm an investigative journalist, a medical political analyst, and an occasional talk show host. Before we get underway today, I want to acknowledge and thank everyone who watched or listened to the program last Monday when I was the guest host. And also a very special thanks to the people who left comments at YouTube. I read and appreciated all of them more than you can know. Now, I do what I do, that is report, analyze, write, and speak in order to share what I know, to share my experience and what I have found out. My only purpose now is to do this for an audience of readers, viewers, and listeners. So without you, it reminds me of the thought experiment that's like a Zen koan. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, technically, of course, yes, it does. But if there's no one there to hear it and respond to it, it may be something else entirely. Now, in the past week, I've been writing and speaking about the premature death of a special person who was both a patriot and a man of deep Christian faith, and that is Philip Haney. And that makes me think about death and life in general. Some of you in your comments at YouTube from last Monday's program said you recalled my guest hosting this program last summer on a number of occasions in July after Joe Hagman passed away way prematurely at age 36. And, of course, for many years, Joe was the co-host of the Hagman Report. And I have to say that not a day goes by that I don't think about Joe and miss him like we all do. And I think it's important to continue to remember and to honor the people we've known, like Phil Haney and Joe Hagman, who have brought some light into this world. And while mentioning that, I just want to take a brief note of another person who I respected and followed, and I know many of you probably did too, and that is Reverend Jack Van Impe. He passed away at age 89 last month, and I discovered Jack Van Impe and his wife Rexella, who were evangelists, Christian evangelists, and then early televangelists, via their weekly syndicated half-hour program, Jack Van Impe Presents. And I was drawn to it initially when I first discovered it, probably about 15 years ago, because Jack and Rexella would review the news of the week and of recent times from a conservative perspective, but also informed by their deep knowledge of Christianity and the Bible. So Jack's passing at, I think, age 89 last month is definitely to be missed. And fortunately, he, like many people of substance who work in the media, left quite a legacy of videos, audios, books, records, LPs, going back to the 1950s. So just to take note of Jack Van Impe, a patriot and a man of faith. Now, the lineup for today's program, I have to admit that I'm much more discombobulated than usual today. It's not that I haven't planned for today's show. Actually, I've been planning for it for several days now, but the news cycle keeps changing, especially with issues like the coronavirus, the political picture of the Democrats running for president, and it's just an unpredictable thrill a minute and a lot of work just to keep up with it and to try to offer some cogent, independent, original analysis. So, in 2017, when I began appearing on the Hagman Report, it was possible then to cover the stories of the week. And now there are simply too many of them, so it's an increasing challenge. Now, a lot of people right now are very concerned about the coronavirus. And as much as most people want a definitive report on this and what is ahead, the future in this case, and even what's really happening at the present moment, remains obscure and largely unknown. Now, some people are out there, especially online, insisting that we are facing an apocalyptic development. Others are insisting that the whole coronavirus thing is largely a big hype. And there are many interpretations in between those two polar points, ranging again from this is it, the end times around the corner, to basically don't worry, be happy. I think it's kind of like the parable of the blind men and the elephant. Each blind man feels a different part of the elephant and thinks he can describe the whole animal accurately just based on that one part that he has felt, when obviously there are a lot of different parts. And this story has a lot of moving parts, probably as many or more than anything I've ever looked into. Now, whatever else it is, in my opinion, the coronavirus is a massive psyop, psychological operation. Whether or not it's a bioweapon or started out as a bioweapon, it's being used now as a political weapon against President Trump. And in history of my studying psyops, psychological operations, the most successful of them are confusing, ambiguous, and they entail a degree of cognitive dissonance. Now, probably the prime example is the assassination of President Kennedy 56 years ago. That may not have started out as a psyop. After all, it was an assassination, and unfortunately a successful one. But it quickly evolved into a psyop. The cover-up, the corruption of the Warren Commission and the Warren Report on the assassination, which was issued in September 1964, about 10 months after JFK was killed. And 56 years later now, despite the publication of literally thousands of books, probably hundreds or more of television and film documentaries, feature films like Oliver Stone's JFK in 1991, and the fact that this was probably the most investigated crime in history, maybe not officially, but by independent investigators and researchers, we still don't know exactly who did it. And there is, of course, film of the assassination, the famous Zapruder 8mm movie film of the entire thing, but there's no smoking gun. Now, what this medical emergency of coronavirus has exposed is that communist China is an authoritarian, violent, repressive police state. And, of course, that shouldn't be new information, but just as the word that the Democratic Party here is communist is news to most people, so it is with what is going on with communist China, which I think we should still call Red China. Now, I spent many years, actually decades, more than four decades, reporting on health and medical issues, including the promise of credible alternative medicine, and even focusing on cancer, as I did at the outset, starting in the early and mid-1970s. It took several years to really get a clear handle on what was going on. Many people were insisting then that Big Pharma, which wasn't called Big Pharma then, but the Big Pharma was calling the shots, or maybe it was the Rockefellers. Actually, there were a lot of players, and not to overlook, which many people did and continued to do, the role of the federal government, which has a vested interest in not only cancer, but AIDS, coronavirus, Medicine Inc., the politics of medicine, and everything else. Now, today, it's even more complicated because we're dealing with China. Basically, in my opinion, we're involved in a new Cold War with Red China, and it's an information war as well. And if you think the United States government has problems telling the truth, well, just take a look at what comes out of Red China. Now, the coronavirus domestically is perfect for the Democrats. It's tailor-made for their obsessions, growing the government and taking down President Trump. That's their purpose in focusing on the coronavirus. Although I have to say that as an aside, this morning, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo had a press briefing in which he talked about the number of cases, small number so far, in New York State, which he's the governor of, that have coronavirus. And he seemed to be trying to put the lid on the attacks and the sensationalism and attempting to reassure people in New York and perhaps nationally that this isn't as bad as it has been made out to be. So in my opinion, small amount of credit finally to Andrew Cuomo for not taking the bait and just running like the rest of the Democrats in attack mode on President Trump. Now, I plan to return to the subject of coronavirus, or actually it's a group of subjects a little bit later in the broadcast. But to me, the thing that's really critical right now is the politics. It's red hot. More than ever, the future of our country, our republic, our freedom are at stake. And in fact, the coronavirus and what we find out about it and how it's dealt with is also, as I've suggested, political. It's a political issue as well as a health issue. And if we lose our freedom politically, as we may, depending on the outcome of this coming November's election, we will definitely lose our ability to deal with the coronavirus or anything else the way that we want to as individuals, as free individuals in this constitutional republic. By the way, another aside, I am sick and tired of hearing every Democrat politician running for president constantly saying we have to restore our democracy that President Trump is threatening. For one thing, we are not a democracy. Democracy is direct vote. It's close to mob rule. Our founders designed a constitutional representative republic. That's what we have. It's not a democracy. Now, I came of age a long time ago when politics, elections, and campaigns were not quite as manipulated and corrupt as they are today. That's an understatement. By the way, another aside, and this is one that came about just last evening. It was Sunday evening, March 1st, that CNN had the latest installment in their series, The Race for the White House, a historical series looking at past campaigns. And last night's hour-long episode was about the 1964 presidential election campaign, which pitted accidental President Lyndon Baines Johnson, the Democrat, who, of course, inherited the office after President Kennedy was assassinated. And his opponent on the Republican side was Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater. And this had special interest for me because it was that election year, 1964, that I caught the political bug. I was deeply inspired by Senator Barry Goldwater. In fact, in this CNN program last night, there was a brief clip of a primetime program that was hosted by Jack Parr after he left The Tonight Show. For several years, he had a Friday night 10 o'clock p.m. program on the NBC network for an hour. And on March 23rd, 1963, he welcomed as one of his guests a one-on-one interview with Senator Barry Goldwater. And that I remember that broadcast. In fact, I audio taped it and listened to it repeatedly. And it was the first time I ever really saw Barry Goldwater in any kind of depth on a television interview. And I just was completely turned on by his conservatism, his libertarian conservatism. And so last night's program on CNN, although of course it was biased, it was revisionist history, every time the program turned to an academic talking head, and I would check out these people, you know, online, who are they, do a little quick research, almost all of them without exception were left-wing academics. There were a few surviving members of Goldwater's campaign from that year, 1965, including Barry Goldwater Jr. And of course, Barry Goldwater Sr., the senator who ran in 1964, died several decades ago. But his son was there. And one of the takeaway sound bites from this program, and I'm surprised they left it in, was when Barry Goldwater Jr. said that his father, Barry Goldwater Sr., did not trust President Lyndon Baines Johnson because, and this is a direct quote, which Jr. attributed to Goldwater Sr., he said, Lyndon Baines Johnson is a bully and a crook. And that summed it up beautifully. In fact, one new piece of information that this program broke last night was the fact that the Lyndon Baines Johnson campaign planted a undercover CIA spy in the Goldwater campaign office in the fall campaign, 1964. And that spy was feeding inside information, including speech texts, internal plans, etc., right into the White House. So the Johnson campaign could take appropriate actions. And doesn't that sound a lot like what the Republicans supposedly did during the Watergate break-in? But of course, the corruption of President Lyndon Baines Johnson has hardly ever been focused on. I was surprised to see it on the CNN program. One thing that really stood out, though, was that in this revisionist history, the producers of this program last night on Goldwater versus Johnson spent much of the time talking about Goldwater, particularly the convention in July of 1964 that nominated him, as if it exposed the racist underpinnings, allegedly, of the Goldwater campaign. And I have to say that I followed, even though I just entered high school, I followed that entire election year and that campaign as closely as anybody could from a distance. And I've read about it ever since, studied it. And I even got to ask Senator Goldwater a couple of questions when he spoke at Georgetown University in November 1969. And I sat in the front row and asked him several questions when it got to the Q&A period. Anyway, I don't remember any allegations at the time, I mean major allegations, substantive allegations that Goldwater was an anti-African-American racist. In fact, in his private life, before he entered politics, he had a role with the department store, Goldwater's, that his family ran in Arizona. And he desegregated that store, I believe, in the late 40s or 1950s, years ahead of any federal law requiring desegregation. He also was a great friend of Native Americans. He was a photographer, a very skilled one. And he used to travel around to his friends in Native American tribes throughout Arizona, flying his own plane, by the way. And I believe one or more of those tribes made him an honorary member because he respected them so much and the feeling was mutual. So it reminded me, it was like CNN was looking at the current lens of any Republican is a racist, Trump is a racist, and therefore any former Republican who was a conservative must be a racist too. But nonetheless, the archival video and audio clips from the program and the still photos were fascinating. So although it helps to know a lot about the subject if you happen to, because then you can sort of weed your way through it and separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. Now, returning to the present, An argument can be made, as I noted last week, that elections today and the campaigns are nothing but a big show, a big play, while the real decision-making, the real plans and strategies for change and control are going on largely unseen behind the curtain somewhere, and they're invisible to us. And that's true. I believe that that's true. But at the same time, the facts of the matter suggest that right now there is someone at the helm of this country, President Donald Trump, who is trying to right the floundering ship of state. Donald Trump is the first person in modern times to occupy the Oval Office who was not a politician to start with. Now, you have to go all the way back to President Eisenhower in the 1950s to find an individual who was not previously a politician, although, of course, in the case of Eisenhower, he did work for the government for most of his life. He was in the military, and after he left the military, he was president of Columbia University for a few years. Imagine that, before he ran for president. But he spent most of his life as a military officer or government employee, and I don't know if there was anyone before him who became president who had not been a politician. I have to check that out. But, of course, Eisenhower was not a bad president either. Now, this year's campaign by the Democrats, especially the revelations of the past several weeks, if not the past several days, has finally brought to light what they really believe in and what they would do if they attain power. Now, breaking news yesterday, actually Sunday early evening, Mayor Pete Buttigieg decided to suspend his campaign. He's out. He's left the campaign. And he addressed a hometown crowd in South Bend, Indiana, introduced by his husband, Chasen Buttigieg. His husband has taken the last name of Buttigieg. Isn't that interesting? And I watched Buttigieg's speech, which was on at about 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. And I have to say it was a well-crafted, well-delivered speech, which is not to say that I agreed with any of it, but it reminded me of, again, the speech that Barack Hussein Obama gave to the Democrat National Convention in 2004, which catapulted him to national attention. It just had just the right tone. It was obviously crafted by some super professionals lurking in the background, which makes me even more suspicious that Mayor Pete Buttigieg is some kind of a cutout figure like Obama was, or there's another term that's used in the intelligence community, a legend. That is an individual who is an asset to the deep state intelligence community, but they might not be a card-carrying member of the CIA. But nonetheless, they are groomed, prepared, and in waiting if the moment comes when they can emerge on the national stage and play a very significant role, as Barack Hussein Obama did. And by the way, I'll pause at this point, and Eric, if you have the video available, which I sent, which is, see how I titled it. The title was Buttigieg, I think Buttigieg channels Obama or something like that. Now, I'm not sure exactly who put this together, but it's a short series of video clips of Barack Obama juxtaposed with Mayor Pete Buttigieg campaigning this year or recently for president. And it has been alleged that Buttigieg has borrowed a lot, if not overtly plagiarized what has come before. But this video is in just a brief minute or less really illustrates that better than anything I could say. So, Eric, if you have that, hopefully, could you please play it now?
A certain audacity to this announcement.
I recognize the audacity.
And church basements and in our schools.
Reaching into church basements and barbershops, into universities.
Light shining as a beacon to the world.
Country we love shines as a beacon around the world.
And if a voice can change a room, it can change a city. And if it can change a city, it can change a state. And if it can change a state, it can change a nation.
And if we can light up a neighborhood, then we can light up a city. And if we can light up a city, we can light up this whole country.
Wow. You know, Pete Buttigieg has dropped out of the race, but I don't like to predict, but I will predict this. We have not heard the last of this guy. He's only 38 now, and he is on a path, a long march to somewhere, and I think that somewhere is going to be power. He's now dropped out of the race, and because he did it before Super Tuesday, which is the primary election coming up tomorrow, Tuesday, March 3rd, in which 14 states will hold primaries and about one-third of the total delegates for the Democrat National Convention nomination for president will be earned tomorrow, Tuesday, March 3rd. Well, Buttigieg surprised people by withdrawing before that. Well, his internal polling as well as external polling probably indicated that he could not look forward to many or any victories tomorrow. So it was a smart strategic move. But even more than that, he now emerges as someone who dropped out for the big picture to try to give or allow momentum, obviously, for Joe Biden, former VP Joe Biden, who emerged surprisingly from the South Carolina primary on Saturday, February 29th, that is 2 days ago. Biden was resuscitated, and his campaign, by the way, on the screen now, if you're watching, there's a look at that shot of Buttigieg. On the left is a crowd. There's an American flag somebody's waving. Buttigieg has a light behind him, so his profile is highlighted. I mean, this is right out of PSYOP Propaganda 101, and that, of course, is credited to probably a news organization. But, you know, they love Pete Buttigieg, and they will, you know, they'll help him in the future. But, you know, he's taken the high road now, and if Joe Biden, who will benefit from him dropping out, if Joe Biden actually gets the nomination and or, God forbid, becomes the next president, Buttigieg, who knows, could become his running mate. He could certainly be available for a cabinet position or, you know, maybe he'll run for Senate or something. Who knows? But they were already chanting last night from his hometown crowd, Pete in 2024. So, yeah, you know, I'm sure he's already planning that move. Okay. Meanwhile, as I mentioned, Joe Biden has been resuscitated. And of course, a lot of this resuscitation with Biden supposedly moving into an equal, if not greater position than Bernie Sanders, who was in the catbird seat for a few days there and who the establishment and the deep state actually don't really like. I mean, Sanders certainly has his constituency and a frighteningly large one. But the administrative state, the deep state, prefers somebody like Biden. And if not Biden, if he falters, well, Steve Bannon was on Fox News again yesterday, Sunday, on the Sunday morning futures show with Maria Bartiromo. He's become kind of a regular on that show, and his perspective and his vantage point are really worth listening to. And he continues to say that Hillary Clinton is available and waiting in the wings if the Democrat convention in July winds up being a brokered convention with no candidate able to win the nomination on the first ballot, that Hillary will be there. Don't count her out. And he's also Bannon has also said don't count out Michelle Obama either, because the Obamas and the deep state clique that they represent are not going to take this one sitting down. They're monitoring things very closely. They are obviously manipulating. Yes, there's a classic photo on the screen now, for those of you watching, of sleepy Joe Biden and crooked Hillary. Not sure when that was taken, but oh, my God. God help us if any of these people get power, you know. But, okay, so Joe Biden is, everybody's watching him tomorrow now, but a lot of the people who prognosticate for a future say, well, don't count Bernie Sanders out yet, that Sanders has a national base that's huge. I mean, Joe Biden has a hard time turning out a couple of hundred people for a campaign rally. Bernie can draw thousands, many thousands of supporters to a rally. So, you know, Bernie's got the juice right now, and he's also very well organized, and he is predicted to do extremely well in California tomorrow and in Texas. And those two states have the most delegates. So if he can win those states, he's going to be very, very far ahead. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. But earlier this year, I was paying close attention to Pete Buttigieg because I was concerned that he was being portrayed as a moderate when, of course, he's a Marxist, socialist, communist, really. And I did several articles for American Thinker. And last Monday, when I guest hosted the Hagman Report, I talked about him and his background in some detail. And it reflects actually on all the Democrat candidates for president, because to one degree or another, they are all now in an extremely left lane. And even Joe Biden, who used to present himself as kind of a moderate, well, Sleepy Joe now, as President Trump tweeted, if Sleepy Joe actually got elected, somebody else would be programming him essentially, or running the show, because Joe is ready for the home. You know, that was illustrated again yesterday when Biden appeared on most of, if not all of, the Sunday morning talk shows. There are five of them, I think. And when he was on Fox News Sunday show with Chris Wallace, actually, I thought Joe did, considering his limitations, a more credible job than usual. Although at the very end, he thanked he didn't thank Chris Wallace. He said, thank you. Now the name is escaping me, of the one on NBC, the host, Chuck. He said, thank you, Chuck. And Chris Wallace had to correct him and say, no, you're talking to Chris. So Joe Biden either doesn't know where he is, what he's talking about, what he did in the past, or who he's talking with at the moment. So we shall see what outs tomorrow. But anyway, I've been putting some new emphasis in my own research on Bernie Sanders, because he is really frightening. What he and his base represent is Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez, Chairman Mao, Vladimir Lenin. That's really what he is into. And so I have a couple of videos. And the first one I'd like to play, let me see if I can find. I sent, you know, thank God we have Eric the Tech on the other end, thousands of miles away from me, because we're kind of connected, it seems, telepathically as well as by Internet Skype. But there's not really the ability, as it is when Doug is hosting the show and he's in the same room with Eric, basically, to give hand signals or to, direct things. So Eric, fortunately, is very quick on the uptake, and he seems to be reading my mind. But the next video is, Sanders at rally, laundry list of free stuff, .mp4. Now, this is Sanders speaking at one rally, and someone has edited this into clips of what he really supports and endorses if he ascends to the presidency. And it's quite a list. Of course, the real list of what he supports is even longer than this. This is just the highlights, but it's bad enough. So, Eric, if you have that, please run it now. Okay, we've got the 30-second warning on that one. By the way, it's very easy to research what these candidates actually want to do. They have their websites, but then they're also credible, more or less independent sites which will evaluate the positions or list the positions of these candidates without comment. They'll just say candidate X, Y, or Z supports this, 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 and this, and they'll give a source, you know, a credible source where the candidate either said that on the campaign trail, promised it, or it's in his or her platform on their website or position paper or whatever. So it's not, you know, if it's looking at Bernie Sanders, it's not a Republican evaluating what Bernie Sanders is all about. It really is what Bernie Sanders says, believes, wants to do, so you can take it to the bank. And it makes it even more scary because it's not an ideological opinion on what these candidates believe in. So, Eric, if you have it, could you please run it now?
We're going to raise that minimum wage to at least $15 an hour. We're going to build 10 million units of affordable and low-income housing. We are going to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. We're going to have universal, high-quality, affordable child care for all. Together, we're going to make public colleges and universities tuition-free. We're going to make trade schools tuition-free. Health care is a human right, not a privilege. We're going to bring that to the United States of America.
There you have it, Bernie Sanders in his own words from one rally, by the way. It's, you know, he and the Democrats have basically two positions in this campaign for president. Number one, we hate Donald Trump. He's a racist. He's destroying our democracy. He's ruined foreign relations. You know, he's just bad news. We got to kick him out of there. In fact, I think Sanders literally said that a day or two ago. We've got to kick him out of there. And the other campaign is for free stuff. The laundry list, each candidate has it. And then some have kind of another position, and that is the hyphenated American divide, where they will appeal to African Americans by insisting, as they seem to do every 4 years, that the Republicans are just a bunch of racists who want to send blacks back to the Jim Crow era. Or, you know, yesterday was interesting, was the celebration, which actually is the 55th anniversary today, March 2nd, of the March on Selma, Alabama, which ended in example of police brutality against peaceful marchers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. And so that congressman who, John Lewis, who was assaulted 55 years ago as he was helping to lead that march, showed up with a large group of people there, as well as most of the Democrats running for president, to take note of the day yesterday. And it was Lewis's first public appearance since it was announced that he's got stage 4 pancreatic cancer. So, of course, he's always referred to as the civil rights icon. He and Jesse Jackson are two of the last surviving quote-unquote icons of the original civil rights movement. So there was John Lewis, who, by the way, has called President Trump a racist, who refused, I believe, to attend his inauguration as a member of Congress, which he is, and State of the Union addresses, because he would not dignify President Trump with his presence. And there he was for CNN and the other left-leaning outlets, which means almost all of them, making extensive remarks with the crowd and being recorded on how vote like your life depends on it in November, because we got to get rid of President Trump. Now, a good, without dwelling on that, another interesting video is, let's see, titled, Eric, Sanders Supports Healthcare and College for Illegals. And this is another one where Bernie Sanders was appearing at an event, and a female who was moderating the event wanted him to clarify his position on, does he in fact support not only providing free health care for anyone who comes here immediately as soon as they get here, but his proposals for free college to be paid for by you and me, basically, that is taxpayers. Would his free college plan, that is free tuition for public and state universities, also apply to illegal immigrants? So here was his answer. So, Eric, if you have that, let her roll. Okay. I've been told to hold on for a second, so I'll just... Oh, I'm sorry. The titles are not... I thought the actual file was titled... Here's a little back and forth with Eric the Tech. I thought the title of this one was Sanders Supports Healthcare and College for Illegals MP4, the actual video file, but maybe that got garbled. I know, you know, it's... There's so much preparation that goes into this, at least on my part. I'm primarily a writer. And when you sit down, or when I sit down to write an article, and it's always been this way going back 5 decades, I've done a ton of research. Okay. I'll just finish this thought. I've got a ton of research. And I try to reference everything. Of course, there's a point of view reflected when you write an article, but I really try to let the facts drive the story or the data and the information. And so it is when I do these broadcasts, there's a lot of preparation. But just earlier today, one of the key files that I had assembled with a lot of information suddenly disappeared. And I always make backups of things. I couldn't find the backup, so there are always little glitches. So bear with us. But I think the file is ready. So here is... Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent socialist running as a Democrat, and he's asked, does he support free health care and free college for illegal immigrants? Here we go.
I believe that health care is a human right.
Senator, would you include the 11 million undocumented immigrants?
Absolutely, absolutely. When I talk about health care being a human right, last time I heard that undocumented people are human beings as well. We need the best educated population in the world. That means we're going to make our public colleges and universities tuition free and open that to the undocumented as well.
Yes, yeah, so the undocumented, like the documented or native-born citizens, can go to college to study, I don't know, black history, gay history, LGBTQ history, climate science, all the other social justice issues. Yes. So there we have it. And Eric, just to give you a heads up, the next video I'd like to play after I introduce it is a clip from 60 Minutes where Anderson Cooper is asking Bernie Sanders, I believe this aired 8 days ago now, how he would pay for some of these proposals. And I think the title of the MP4 file was Anderson Cooper Asks Sanders How He Will Pay for It All. So I'll give you a moment to try to track that down. But this is the question that has been asked of Bernie Sanders infrequently. You know, the mainstream media, if they conduct a town hall with these candidates or in the debates, they just either give them softball questions as if they're written, as if the questions are written by the Democrat National Committee, or they don't do any follow-up. So the Democrats can make these grandiose proposals and promising pie in the sky, and rarely, if ever, are they actually asked the specifics, how they're going to pay for it. And to his minor credit, at least, Anderson Cooper, former CIA operative, by the way, asked Sanders how he would pay for it. But of course, you have to keep in mind here that Anderson Cooper, working for CBS and, primarily CNN, but also he's loaned out to CBS and 60 Minutes, is basically a deep state operative. And as I said earlier, the deep state, the administrative state, which is the permanent bureaucracy that runs this country, literally tens of millions of government workers at the local, state, and federal level who, their religion is government and control. So most of them are Democrats. Most of them are friendly to socialist Democrats, and they want to grow their business, meaning the government. And Anderson Cooper is, in my opinion, one of their mouthpieces. So, Eric, if you have that video of AC on 60 Minutes, maybe you could play that now.
How much will that cost?
Obviously, those are expensive propositions, but we have done our best on issue after issue in paying for them.
Do you know how much, though? I mean, do you have a price tag for all of this?
We do. I mean, you know, and the price tag is, it will be substantially less than letting the current system go. I think it's about $30 trillion.
That's just for Medicare for all.
Just Medicare for all, yeah.
Do you have a price tag for all of these things?
No, you mentioned making public colleges and universities tuition-free and canceling all student debt. That's correct. That's what I want to do. We pay for that through a modest tax on Wall Street speculation.
But you say you don't know what the total price is, but you know how it's going to be paid for. How do you know it's going to be paid for if you don't know how much the price is?
Well, I can't rattle off to you every nickel and every dime.
This is better than the old Saturday Night Live, isn't it? I mean, the new Saturday Night Live, in my opinion, has totally gone off the rails for years now. But watching these clips, they're funny. They're hilarious. If they weren't so telling and dangerous, because if these people take power, I mean, they're crazy. They're sociopaths at the very least, and probably psychopathological. And there was a very good example. Eric, here's a heads up for the next one I would like to show. It's a very brief clip titled Sanders Rally Lurching to the Left. And there's a corresponding still shot that I pulled from that video, which was titled JPEG, Angry Radicals at Bernie Rally. So maybe you could have both of them on deck. But this is an interesting clip, assuming we can get to it, because Bernie Sanders is being introduced at a recent rally, and just as an aside, the people you see in the frame are all people of color. Yes, there is the still. There is a young woman speaking at the mic, about to introduce Bernie, and she appears to be maybe an Indian, you know, South Asian Indian American or from that area. Of the planet. And then this character on the left of the screen is screaming, holding a Bernie sign. And basically everybody's yelling and screaming there in that little area that I've isolated from the video. But to hear this woman and what she actually says, and in my opinion, I think it's pretty clear, it's pretty obvious that she speaks for the Bernie Sanders constituency. And exit polls, as well as other studies, have shown that Bernie Sanders' base is not exclusively, but largely, I mean, his greatest strength is in young Americans, or I should say people who live here and can vote, who are under the age of 40. They love Bernie. And of course, it's obvious why that would be the case, because they've been educated, quote unquote, in the last two decades or so, when education in this country at both the public school level and the university college level has gone right down the drain, you know, complete political correctness, identity politics, anger, victimhood, et cetera, and dismissing the United States as a racist, sick country. And the Democrats, of course, are trying to ride that to power. But here, if we have that, is a little clip of Bernie Sanders being introduced at a recent rally on his half with a very enthusiastic crowd.
Meanwhile, the Democratic Party is lurching to the left, as evidenced by a Gallup poll that reveals 76%, three-quarters of the country, of Democrats would vote for a socialist.
And nowhere is the rise of socialism more clear than at a Bernie Sanders rally. Take a look.
We need a powerful socialist movement to end all capitalist oppression and exploitation.
How does it feel to be a bunch of radicals? Huh? A bunch of revolutionaries. A bunch of socialists here in Myrtle Beach.
Wow.
Wow. That last comment was by the female host of Fox and Friends, the morning show on the Fox News Channel, from which that clip was taken. I neglected to mention that that was a clip from a Fox News, Fox and Friends morning show broadcast last week. And another footnote here, that reminds me again to say on behalf of Fox News to counter the self-styled, self-important critics out there who continue to diss Fox News and say, oh, it's just another mainstream media source. It's just, it's controlled opposition, you know, and it's just not true. I mean, this is where most of these clips, in fact, that I've been playing have been isolated from Fox News broadcasts. And just last evening on Fox News, there was an hour brand new program, A History of Socialism, an unauthorized history of socialism, a one-hour news program anchored by Bret Baier, the anchor of the main news anchor of Fox News, who co-hosts with Martha McCallum the political coverage, breaking news coverage of politics, and also Bret Baier hosts the 6 p.m. Eastern Time Monday through Friday Fox News hour-long hour program. And this was an incredibly insightful program on the history of socialism and also Marxism and communism, which are basically all the same, and how it has basically failed and destroyed every country that has fallen for it. I mean, would a controlled opposition media outlet present something like that? Of course not. Oh, and by the way, also, this coming Thursday, that is March 5th, 2020, starting in the second half hour of the Fox News nightly program anchored by Bret Baier, that is starting at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 3:30 p.m. Pacific Time, that program, Fox News, Thursday, March 5th, will present a town hall with President Donald Trump. His first town hall of this presidential race year. And in fact, I was trying to remember if he had done any town halls in 2016. And I can't think of one that comes to mind. Perhaps he did. I'm going to have to research that. But it's the Democrats who have been doing town halls. In fact, today, Bloomberg, former mayor Mini Mike Bloomberg, scheduled to do one on Fox News early this evening. I haven't checked to see if that actually happened, but that will be an interesting one to watch. And, you know, the transcripts of these appearances are fascinating because a town hall or an extensive interview is ultimately much more valuable in assessing the let's say, intelligence or validity of a candidate than these ridiculous debates or the things that are called debates, which at most allow sound bites. And for a glib, fast talker like Mayor Pete Buttigieg, they can do quite well in a debate setting, but it's all talk, right? It's all talk, and where is the action? So when there can actually be an hour-long town hall format with questions from the audience as well as the moderators. Of course, when these town halls are on MSNBC or CNN, they are pretty much rigged in advance. The questions are pre-selected, and the host moderator knows what the questions are in advance. And in some cases, in the last election cycle, 2016, even the candidate knew what some of the questions were when Donna Brazile leaked some of the questions to, I believe it was Hillary Clinton. And so it goes. But nonetheless, this is what's going on now. So just moving on a bit with Bernie Sanders here. You can say a lot about him. We have no idea, of course, at this point, even though a lot of people are predicting, who's going to wind up challenging President Trump in the fall. And what's pretty clear, though, is that Sanders is a Marxist and a communist. I mean, don't those clips speak for themselves? He insists he's a, quote, democratic socialist. Well, that's BS. Socialism is the means you use to get power by winning elections. Then once in office, like Hitler or Hugo Chavez, both of whom were elected, or Hitler's party won seats in the Reichstag and Hitler assumed power. Hugo Chavez was elected outright in December 1998 as president of Venezuela, and he drove that country totally into the ground in the next 21 years because he died in 2013, and his successor Maduro is another chip off the old block there. And but as I've said today and earlier, it's not only Bernie Sanders who's a socialist, Marxist, or communist, or fellow traveler. It's even the shrinking number of presidential candidates that we are left with. And any new ones who might emerge, if there is a deadlock at the convention, will also be far-left statists, collectivists, globalists, socialists with Marxist sympathies. Radical on issues including climate change, reparations for slavery, open borders, government-run medicine, free education with the rest of us paying for it, judicial reform, meaning crimes are redefined as normal, high taxes on those who are productive and who actually work for a living, and on and on and on. I think pretty much every candidate who is still contending in the Democrat race, and even let's say if Hillary Clinton or Michelle Obama or some unknown person gets the call, he or she will agree with all of those positions I've just mentioned. Absolutely. That's where the base of the Democratic Party is. And of course, the deep state and the establishment is uncomfortable with maybe a limited number of them, but they can be kind of smoothed around the edges, and the end result will pretty much be the same. So again, I ask anyone listening to or watching this program, can any of you seriously say that as we sit here, President Trump is not orders of magnitude superior to any of these Democrats? I mean, please, please. I'll be the first one to admit that President Trump is not perfect. I don't agree with him 100% of the time. There's a lot of things that he does that I think are strategically not maybe the best choices, but I mean, come on. The alternative is the hammer and sickle. So, you know, that's the way it is there. Now, we are coming up on the top of the hour, this first hour of the Hagmann Report today. And if you missed the very beginning, well, I'm Peter Barry Chalka, sitting in for Doug Hagmann, who's off today, but he will be back tomorrow, Tuesday, March 3rd, Super Tuesday. And I've gotten word that on Wednesday of this week, March 4th, Doug is going to have a very special first-time guest. And so look out for that program. But Eric, if we're ready to take the break at the top of the first hour, I'm ready, and I hope you are too. We'll be back. Please stay tuned right after this brief break.
Reporting on what the mainstream media won't, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network.
Exposing the New World Order, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network. Stand by. Doug and Joe will be back shortly.
Welcome to hour number two of the Hagman Report for Monday, March 2nd, 2020. I'm Peter Barry Chalka, sitting in today as a guest host for Doug Hagman, and Doug will be back in the host chair tomorrow, Tuesday, March 3rd, which is also Super Tuesday. Now, in this second hour, it's going to be a bit more free form because I want to talk to some extent in more detail about the coronavirus. And this is really a difficult one, in my opinion, to nail down. As I mentioned at the start of the first hour tonight, I have a long background reporting on medical issues, and specifically medical political issues as well as medical scientific issues. And they're all really complicated because the medical industrial complex in this country is the number one business. It eclipses everything else. People often thought that the military was the biggest thing. They'd say, well, we've got to cut military spending. Well, medicine in this country, the total cost of medical care, half of which already is paid for by the federal government, the total bill for medicine in this country eclipses the military budget by at least a factor of five. It's about five times as big as the military. Maybe it's even bigger now. And it just keeps growing. And this is why the push for socialized government-run single-payer Medicare for all medicine, no matter what name you put on it, it means the government will run the show and change 30 plus years of medicine and turn it on its head by having the government run it with no private options and little or no choice. It's because people are fed up with the rising costs. And even though Obamacare, which was passed, shoved down our throats in the Congress 10 years ago, was supposed to solve all these problems and didn't, well, now we are told we need instead full-blown socialized medicine, Medicare for all. But anyway, anything that comes under the umbrella of Medicine Inc., as I call it, Medicine Inc., Medicine Incorporated, is a real can of worms. And now it's made even more complicated or murky, I would say, by all of the self-appointed experts on the left and the right and every other ideological vantage point who cite some of them, you know, unnamed sources at high levels or information tidbits that suggest that this or that is going to pan out now in the case of the coronavirus. Now, I heard the same thing going back to another earlier virus, HIV, in the 1980s. There were apocalyptic predictions made starting in the mid-80s and really through the early 90s by both deep state, administrative state operatives in the federal government, the National Institutes of Health, and by many special interest groups that the AIDS thing was really going to take off. And as Oprah Winfrey said on one of her programs in 1987, mouthing statistics, I'm sure, provided to her by the government, that by the early 90s, 1 in 4 Americans might be dead from AIDS. Well, nothing close ever happened like that. So here we are with another outbreak of something very different, of course. But, you know, in recent days, I've been consulting among many sources, including the peer-reviewed scientific literature, which has been covering the coronavirus. In fact, the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the leading mainstream journals, had an article published on Friday, February 28th, about the coronavirus, and it was attributed to scores of Chinese medical doctors who have actually been doing the treating and the researching over there. Now, you could argue, I guess, that they are fudging some of the statistics, but this is the clearest thing we have to go by about what's going on in China. And this information is being echoed now by, I think, responsible spokespeople and experts in the United States, including in the Trump administration, which is really trying to get a handle on this. And that is that the coronavirus is really not that much different from the flu, the annual flu, which hits this country and the world. And yes, there on the screen is part of the New England Journal study from 3 days ago. It's very, very current. Clinical characteristics of coronavirus disease 2019 in China. And this is rather unusual for a medical journal, which usually doesn't put much online that's not behind a paywall. They've made this study and other reports, studies, editorials about the coronavirus freely available and accessible, so anybody can basically track it down and read it and then measure it and compare it with things that other hopefully responsible people are saying. Now, one of them who I want to cite in terms of responsible and credible is a friend of mine going back 3 decades, and that's John Rappaport. And John, who has been on this program in the past, continues to write and publish at his main site, nomorefakenews.com. And John has written a couple of things in the last week that have really stood out to me. So I'm just going to see if I can call up the correct file here so I can cite or quote this hopefully knowledgeably and not just from the seat of my pants. But actually, before I get to John, let me just quote a few things from the New England Journal on February 28th. Said, citing analysis of the available data from the outbreak in China, the authors of the study that Eric just showed the part of on the screen, the authors note that there have been 0 cases among children younger than 15. I mean, this is in China where they have, 80,000 people testing positive, several thousand deaths. So 0 cases among children younger than 15, and that the fatality rate is 2% at most, considerably, and could be considerably less than 1%. Now, this suggests that we really don't know what percent to attach to this yet. It's very, very new in the medical literature and even in clinical observation. And earlier today, Governor Cuomo was putting the figure, I think, of 1.6% mortality rate. And he mentioned that the mortality rate from conventional flu every year is at least 0.6%. So if this is true, the coronavirus so far is not responsible for a higher death rate than the conventional flu. And others have made the point that these statistics of deaths from corona are coming from communist China, which, whatever else you say about it, does not have a medical system that's as good as we have here in the United States. I mean, conventionally speaking, if you have a life-threatening viral-induced disease, you're better off in the United States with what's available here in conventional medicine than you would be in communist China, where they're probably just as happy to take you to a crematorium and not have to, you know, expend any energy on you. So when you actually get down to trying to look at the facts and the data, it's a little different than what some people are saying out there. Let's see. Okay, I'm quoting from the New England Journal. The authors note that coronavirus looks to be much less severe than other recent outbreaks of respiratory illness. The overall clinical consequences of COVID-19, the official name of coronavirus, may ultimately be more akin to those of a severe seasonal influenza or a pandemic influenza, similar to that in 1957 and 68, rather than a disease similar to SARS or MERS, which have had case fatality rates of 9 to 10% and 36% respectively. Now, we're getting down in the weeds here with these statistics and percentages and all, but, you know, it is important. And actually, I suggest anyone listening to or watching this who really wants to get into this, you've got to start reading stuff. You know, if you just listen to podcasts, including this one, or programs, you know, you're going to get so much of the story, and you're going to get it through the lens of somebody who may or may not have an axe to grind. I like to think that I don't, because I'm not monetizing anything here. I'm just trying to put out the information, and I've got a long history of medical reporting, and I know how to read and understand the scientific literature and make sense out of it. Now, here's a little video we can get ready to show. All of these attacks by the Democrats on President Trump and his administration for what it is claimed they are not doing, or for their quote-unquote incompetence in dealing with the corona outbreak. Well, there was another serious influenza virus several years ago during the administration of Barack Hussein Obama. And writing in PJ Media, Victoria Taft notes that the response of the Obama administration to this earlier infection, a swine flu pandemic in 2009, literally infected millions of Americans and resulted in more than 1,000 deaths, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And yet Obama didn't do very much about this at all. And I think, 20,000 people were hospitalized during that epidemic. And so meanwhile, here is an example, Eric, if you have this video ready, of what President Obama advised Americans to do during that outbreak of this pandemic swine flu, which, by the way, was not treated by the mainstream media as this kind of apocalyptic example of complete incompetence on the part of a sitting administration. No, it was on the back pages, more or less. But when Obama finally commented on it, here's something that he said addressing the American people. So, Eric, if you have that, please play it now.
I just want to provide everyone with a few brief updates on some of the challenges we're dealing with right now. First, we are continuing to closely monitor the emergency cases of the H1N1 flu virus throughout the United States. As I said this morning, this is obviously a very serious situation, and every American should know that their entire government is taking the utmost precautions and preparations. Our public health officials have recommended that schools with confirmed or suspected cases of this flu strongly consider temporarily closing. And if more schools are forced to close, we've recommended that both parents and businesses think about contingency plans if their children do have to stay home. I've requested an immediate $1.5 billion in emergency funding from Congress to support our ability to monitor and track this virus and to build our supply of antiviral drugs and other equipment. And we will also ensure that those materials get to where they need to be as quickly as possible. And finally, I've asked every American to take the same steps you would take to prevent any other flu. Keep your hands washed. Cover your mouth when you cough. Stay home from work if you're sick, and keep your children home from school if they're sick. We'll continue to provide regular updates to the American people as we receive more information, and everyone should rest assured that this government is prepared to do whatever it takes to control the impact of this virus.
There you have it, Barack Hussein Obama in 2009 talking about an earlier, and that actually was a pandemic that took over 1,000 lives. Now, the next video I'd like to play, because this really suggests what we're dealing with in terms of a communist China or red China, and I think lends credence to concerns that it's in the interests of the deep state, the administrative state, the military, the controllers, as it were, the people who want to control us, who sit in power, and the world, and in fact this country, is becoming actually and unfortunately more like China. In fact, Marco Rubio had a great quote yesterday when he was interviewed on Sunday Morning Futures with Maria Bartiromo on Fox News. He said, "I think one of the critical mistakes that was made in the last 20 years is the belief that capitalism would change China, when in fact it's China that has changed capitalism," end quote. Now, you can see validity in that, in everything from the quality of products made in China, which fill the shelves of stores like Walmart and Target and pretty much every place else now. The quality is low compared to when similar or earlier products were manufactured in the United States or even in other foreign countries. I mean, you can relate that to the quality of off-the-rack clothing, electronic equipment. It's really true across the board. But also, we know that big tech is testing and implementing its tyrannical designs for our future in Red China. China is the petri dish for Silicon Valley as they, you know, Google, et cetera, perfect their software, their algorithms to monitor and control the population. And if we think that's not going to come here, in fact, it already is, then we've got another thing coming. So, as an example, this video, which I want to play next, has been making the rounds, and it was originally released by as kind of an exercise or training video in communist China recently, and because of its wide distribution in social media and even in mainstream media and alternative media, a lot of people think it's actually a real event. When it's a training exercise, but it shows what the Chinese are prepared to do and presumably are doing in enforcing these lockdowns of people who are supposed to remain at home in these areas that are contaminated or susceptible to the coronavirus. And Eric, when we play this, I wonder, is it possible to have my mic open so I can narrate what's on the screen, because people listening. Okay, so I will do that. It runs about 2 minutes because there's no There are versions of this where people narrate it, but I found one which is just the original and just has the original Chinese people speaking, but of course it's unintelligible and it's not very good audio anyway. So I will do just a brief color narration of what we're seeing on the screen for people who might be listening to the audio. So again, this is a about a 2-minute video, and let me introduce it by saying, here's what you'll see. It's a sedan, a late model dark-colored car, approaching a roadblock somewhere in China, and there are menacing-looking figures with Chinese characters on their uniforms, and it also in English it says SWAT, S-W-A-T. In fact, there's a lot of English on the signs and things. I didn't realize there was so much English on roadsides and things in China. But you can also see a sign on a sign, saying exercise. But so this car drives up. The gun-toting people at the checkpoint take the driver's temperature, and the driver's wearing a surgical mask. And apparently they don't like the result either of his temperature or what he said in the brief interview, the interrogation. So they ask him to get out of the car. He refuses and instead tries to drive on through the roadblock. But meanwhile, people ahead of his car have thrown one of those spike chain things on the road, which would deflate his tires. So he pulls to a stop, gets out of the car, at which point he is treated rather roughly. At one point, one of the guards, one of the authorities there puts what looks like a bird net to capture a bird or an insect over his head, and they take this guy away, and then they start to disinfect with spraying everybody who had contact with him, including his car. But anyway, we can start the recording playback, and then I'll just do a little narration as it goes forward. So I'll let it roll. Here initially we see the yellow jacketed police, it says, motioning the car and the driver to stop. Another person goes over to take his temperature with one of those forehead reading devices. Now we see somebody who's several people holding those handheld barriers, like to prevent rocks or missiles being thrown at them. One of them has a hood on. It says SWAT on the back of his ballistic vest. Driver takes off. Tires down. Stop. Choice. Now the SWAT officers move in, order the driver to get out. He gets out and rips his surgical mask off for some reason. Now this is all an exercise, not real. Now he is accosted by these men wearing bulletproof vests, and their heads are covered. They take him off. That's the last we see of the driver. And now other people enter the scene who will start spraying the group that had any contact at all with this driver. So apparently they suspect him of either testing positive for the virus based on his temperature or what he told them. Maybe he was coming from Wuhan. So they're working on his car. They spray that inside and out. And, if this is really something to behold. I mean, get ready for your next, pleasure trip to China. I mean, wow. And, then the last thing we will see is, another individual enters the scene. By the way, meanwhile, there's going in the other direction. There's normal traffic. There's trucks moving through, I guess, the checkpoint going in the other direction. Then one of these suited, protected officials or police people gets in the car and drives it away. So, I mean, this is a very, very compelling video, however you want to think of that. And, yes, I say, you know, I don't have an argument for people who say we have to be aware and vigilant that this kind of thing could come here at some point, that it's probably already on the drawing boards and if not exercises going on here. But wouldn't you think that that's more likely if the government is given even more power to control our medical choices, in fact, eliminating choices. And there is a still from that rather alarming video. And this video has really made the rounds, so it probably see it elsewhere too. But so anyway, just to now I noticed looking at John Rappaport's site, he's very prolific, and he just today has issued a new article, which let me just call this one up here. I've got so many windows open. Okay, his new one is The Contagion of Propaganda, and just the first sentence. As my readers know, this is John Rappaport, the virus is coming, the virus is coming. As my readers know, I've been presenting evidence that this so-called viral epidemic is unproven. I've detailed the fraud from a number of angles. And now John and I are on a very similar track here, because John Rappaport, well, I began reporting on health and medical issues about 15 years before John did. I started in the early and mid-1970s, and primarily with the then new war on cancer, the government war on cancer, which started in 1971 and federalized the search for a cancer cure, which has never panned out, of course, as I discussed last week on this program. And So anyway, I was finding that the politics of cancer was more complex than the science of cancer. But interestingly, and this is largely forgotten now, in the 1970s, one of the first fronts in the official war on cancer was the search for a virus explanation of cancer causation and therefore a cure, which the virology department at the National Cancer Institute, which was kind of the tail wagging the dog then, they felt that a cancer vaccine, anti-cancer vaccine, would be the answer to cancer. Well, hundreds of millions of dollars were thrown at that dead end, did not pan out. But look what happened. In the next decade, the 1980s, what came to be called the AIDS syndrome, or HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, was the name given to this syndrome of illnesses that were showing up mainly in the homosexual community and intravenous drug users. And of course, there's a long history about the railroading of science to fit into that convenient explanation, which was, of course, politically correct and a boondoggle for big pharma and also for government. And that's when John started writing about medical things. And he published a book in 1988 called AIDS Incorporated, reporting on his research. And I felt, now, I was doing some reporting on AIDS myself then, and that's how I first met John back in the late 1980s. And I thought, wow, this is so interesting, because AIDS Incorporated is really resembling Cancer Incorporated that I had reported on 15 years earlier. And literally, some of the same people who had failed in their search to establish a viral or virus cause and treatment for cancer emerged in the 80s to jump onto what they called AIDS, the symptoms which were emerging. And they said, aha, it has a viral explanation, and we're going to search for a vaccine for viral, you know, antiviral cures or treatments, which, of course, they're still doing today, although they do have some drug treatments which have supposedly extended the life of people with HIV/AIDS, but not without toxic consequences in many cases. But it's been a long road since then. And of course, also since then, more recently, we've had SARS and MERS and now this coronavirus, and they all kind of fit the same pattern. There's a tremendous amount of propaganda, misinformation, a corruption of science. I mean, just look at the science around climate change to see a really good example, a gold-plated example of corruption of science. But of course, it happens in Medicine Inc. too. So it helps if you have kind of a grounding in this kind of reporting and analysis so you can connect the dots, as it were, look between the lines and see, draw parallels, which is with things which have come previously, like in the cancer war, the AIDS war, et cetera. So really, there's nothing new under the sun. And John Rappaport, in my opinion, is one of the few people who's really writing very, very coherently and correctly, in my opinion, on this. But he's not the only one either. I mean, last Friday, there was Alex Jones, and actually his guest host that day for most of it was Mike Adams, on InfoWars, and they were really taking the kind of apocalyptic view in between selling supplements and food storage items, which of course are very good to plan for and to have. I mean, that just is common sense. But they were certainly ringing the bell for, you know, this is going to be really, really bad, and we ain't seen nothing yet. But even so, one of the guests that Mike Adams interviewed, and this was the first time I heard of this fellow, and let's see if I can find his name and information. So many files. Okay. Bear with me for 1 second here. Okay. I'm scanning quickly a list of 30 or 40 files. There was an individual named, and of course I'm not finding it. Well, dead air, let's see. First course of talk radio or talk television. Bear with me. In the meantime, say a prayer for the United States and for all of us. By the way, I have a good friend going into surgery this week, so if you're into intercessory prayer, please include him in your prayers. I haven't had a friend saying a prayer for me for this broadcast today when I said that I'm feeling more discombobulated than usual. And here is some evidence. Okay, here it is, I think. Yes. Okay, there was an individual on InfoWars. Here's an anomaly. I open this file and there's no content except the title. Okay, James Lyons hyphen Weiler, W-I-L-E-R, Ph.D., was a guest on InfoWars, and he has a prolific site, James Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, Weiler, W-E-I-L-E-R.com. Things you don't yet know but need to know about the novel coronavirus, including treatment information and how to prepare. And it seemed very down to earth. And there, Eric, very quick on the uptake, has it on the screen for those watching. Among other things, James Lyons Weiler claims that the coronavirus is not a bioweapon. Now, I found that a refreshing comment because whether it is or not, I think we have very scant information to confirm that. And I like to see confirmation before we run off half-cocked making claims. But there's another thing that both John Rappaport has written about and I've been looking into as well, and that is the role of the rollout of 5G in of all places, Wuhan, China, last fall. Now, Eric, I think I sent a URL for an article from Xinhua, X-I-N-H-U-A, which is the Red Chinese International Wire Service in multiple languages. Yes, and now look at this. An article from Xinhua, the Red Chinese, I think you might say propaganda arm. I mean, it's like the Associated Press or UPI or whatever, which are also propagandistic at times. Here's the article published last October 31st, 2019. That was well before any of the coronavirus reports and probably before it even started in Wuhan province, China, we are told. Title of the article is Central China Province Launches Commercial 5G Applications. And this is an incredible article replete with a photo slideshow. suggesting with a great amount of pride that Wuhan, this large, previously unknown city, unknown to us in Red China, was one of the key places that was the site of the early rollout of this 5G technology that we've been hearing so much about. As some people are warning us about 5G, that it's completely untested, unproven, and that, in fact, there are studies showing that this kind of high-impact electromagnetic pollution is not good for body, mind, or spirit. So this article details the extent of this rollout, which, of course, is meant to facilitate not only state-of-the-art cell phone use with the 5G modem in the new cell phones, but the Internet of Everything. You know, predictions are that within a few years, the number of connected devices connected to the Internet, I mean, basically everything we use that you plug in or that runs on batteries, is going to be connected to the Internet through 5G Wi-Fi or cellular connections. So, and not only that, the next rollout will be thousands of Earth-orbiting satellites, which will be providing 5G connections to every place on the planet, literally every square inch on the planet, including the poles, including places that are out there. In the wilderness, will have connection to the Internet because of orbiting 5G satellites. I mean, this is – it's difficult for the mind to even grasp what's going on here. And Wuhan was the city where Red China – one of the cities where Red China was really rolling this stuff out. So, you know, there are – I mean, questions need to be asked about that, don't they? Now, here's a story that I intended to break or at least cover last week when I guest hosted the Hagman Report, and we ran out of time. And this actually factors into what we've been talking about with 5G and the Internet of Everything. And, you know, I've been noting how the dangers of, in particular, cellular phone technology, which is only 13 years old, the smartphone, that is, came out in 2007 with the first iPhone, followed shortly thereafter by the Android phones. And now almost literally every person on the planet, no matter how poor they are, they've got a cell phone. And that's how most people are connecting to the Internet now. So the dangers that I have seen and have documented, as well as some scientific studies and other writers, is that the pervasiveness of the smartphone device and its small screen and what can fit on that screen and how we can use the mini computer, which is the cell phone, have basically shrunk our awareness and intelligence in so many ways. I mean, people have their face buried in their cell phone even when they're at the beach or taking a walk or driving. And they're almost completely not even there with the reality that they're walking through or living through. Also, in terms of information, yes, the cell phone can be a great sharing networking device for instant information and communication. But it's also what will fit on that small screen. And we have the commensurate rise of social media that interestingly parallels the adoption of the smartphone technology starting in the latter half of the first decade of the century. And now social media pretty much runs the day. I mean, a majority of people now say they get their news from social media feeds. And, of course, there is a Wizard of Oz behind the curtain there. You know, it's just dumbing everybody down and, in my opinion, making things very problematic. But in addition to that, there was a new study published in an addiction journal, a peer-reviewed Medline indexed scientific journal of addiction, which means it's a serious publication. And basically, the title of it is Brains of People Addicted to Their Smartphones Physically Change Shape. And this story actually was broken in the mainstream by the Daily Mail on February 18th of this year. How Smartphone Addiction Changes Your Brain. And by the way, I tracked down the original study as published in the scientific literature to read it for myself. So here are some of the key takeaways from this scientific study, which was performed in Europe on a sample of, the German researchers examined the brains of 48 participants using MRI images, imaging scans of their brains. 22 of the people were what are considered smartphone addicts. And this is an actual psychological designation now. SPA, smartphone addiction. It's a syndrome that's being noticed in the medical, scientific, and psychological literature. Smartphone addiction, SPA. So 22 of the people whose brains were scanned were smartphone addicts. And then there was a control group of 26 non-addicts. So they were the people, the guinea pigs in this study. Researchers found diminished gray matter volume in key regions of the brain of the smartphone addicts. And similar phenomena were observed in people, that is the diminution of gray matter, have been observed in people who suffer with substance addiction, you know, addiction to illicit drugs, for example. So the images, the MRIs also reveal that in the smartphone addicts, there was decreased activity in the brains of smartphone addicts compared to the non-addicts. So decreased activity as well as a diminishment or diminution in the size of the gray matter in certain areas of the brain. And again, similar patterns and trends of dwindling gray matter have also been recorded in the mind of drug addicts. So when I read that, I mean, it was a mind-boggling thing to see and then to track down the study and to confirm that, yes, this is real. But, of course, very little of this research actually goes on. And, I mean, there have been other studies that we'll get glimpses of sometimes in the mainstream press where a study somewhere, which is never heard from again after it's published and remains behind a paywall and costs like $40 to get access to that one study, which is not unusual. A study will find that people who are addicted to social media or their smartphones are more depressed or suicidal or unhappy. And, I mean, it really makes common sense when you think about it, and studies are finally confirming this. But you know, here we have it in its full flower. So, you know, this is another angle or aspect, in my opinion, of what's going on here. We have the rollout of 5G in Wuhan and in other areas of China, as well as here now, too. We have the incredible proliferation of smartphone technology, which is basically the fastest adoption of any new state-of-the-art technology in the history of the world. It's even faster and more pervasive and more interactive and engaging than television, which is probably the second closest thing. Television really was burst on the scene in the late 1940s, but did not achieve a complete penetration into vast majority of American households until the early 1960s. And of course, television then was not interactive. Now we have, computers, obviously, using a television-like screen, although a flat screen, were interactive. And now the smartphone is interactive. By the way, I'm reminded of a study that I found in 1976, speaking of television. And this is interesting when you compare it to how the technology has shrunk and is now sitting in our pocket or our hand or on our bedside table were with it 24/7, that is the smartphone. In 1976, there was a study which found that it confirmed the deleterious or harmful effects of television itself. And television at the time, of course, consisted of a large cathode rayed tube sitting inside a box that emitted electromagnetic radiation of some sort. And supposedly color TVs were more intense in that area than black and white. But this experiment had two mouse colonies, two healthy mouse colonies. One of them was placed in front of, well, they were placed in front of identical television receivers. Both receivers had their sound off. One of them had the picture, the in front of the picture tube, in front of the screen, was just like a piece of cardboard or opaque paper. So the mouse colonies could not hear or see what was on the TV. They were living in front of this TV that was turned on all the time. And the content on the TV didn't matter. The TV was on some channel. But, you know, the mouse colony was shielded simply from viewing it, but not prevented by a lead shield, which was in front of the other mouse colony. Now, the mouse colony that was not shielded with lead, living in front of this TV and growing up, you know, young mice that are maturing, et cetera, the unshielded mouse colony started exhibiting completely aberrant behavior, cannibalism, you know, all kinds of really toxic behaviors. And the other one that was shielded by lead was normal. And I always thought, isn't that interesting? And why was that never followed up on, you know? And well, it's obvious because television by then was the medium. And how are you going to turn that around? Just like cell phones now, heading towards the 5G breakthrough, are the media of the moment, the device that everyone has to have. So the world is now being designed around the smartphone, the internet of everything, and 5G. And of course, you have ancillary questionable fields like AI, artificial intelligence, and the related algorithms, which seem to be controlling everything. So it's not even people who are responsible anymore for what goes on with Google or Facebook. It's some bot, some algorithm somewhere. And who are you going to hold accountable there? You know, we have the moves towards transhumanism, these lunatics who, some of them who run Silicon Valley, want to live forever. They want to merge themselves with technology and computers or chips, and God knows where that's going. So, you know, when you start considering this, yes, the political game, the political play is maybe lower down on the scale. And yet, if we continue to put into power politicians who simply want to control us, who I would argue are not like President Trump, then our goose is definitely cooked here. So it's all related. I think all of these dots can be, to return it to ground zero again, can be related in the final analysis. But it's a sad state of affairs out there. So John Rappaport, I recommend nomorefakenews.com for some interesting and provocative reading. And again, I don't agree with John on everything. There's nobody I agree with on 100% of everything they say, right? Or, I mean, there's some I agree with a lot, and John is one of them. Now, there was another individual who I found, who I've known of for a long time. His name is Bill Sardi. And I think he's in his early 70s now, but he's been around forever as a writer, journalist, and a vitamin supplement spokesperson in the industry, but with considerable credibility. He writes articles and books that are sourced and referenced. So he's written a number of things about the coronavirus, including an article titled "Here Is the Cure for the 2019 NCORE Coronavirus." And he had another article here which was very provocative, and I'm just looking for that in my title, in my file bank here to see if I can find that. It was something like, yes, why I want to be infected. There we go. Wow, Eric, is we are really on the beam here. Why I want to be infected with the COVID-19 coronavirus, and you should too. Well, that's the kind of title that, oops, that's the kind of title that you put on an article to make it clickbait. But it's a provocative title, but an interesting title, and he fleshes it out with a long article which talks about, again, what's the big deal here? You know, be healthy, stay healthy, take steps to maintain your health, you know, natural therapeutic steps preventatively. And if you are unfortunate enough to come down with something flu-like, including even a case of the coronavirus, which is rarely fatal, and actually rarely that disruptive and rarely requires hospitalization, well, just take steps in the natural products way to deal with it. And, you know, when you have someone like him who knows the landscape of natural products, vitamins, supplements, herbs, diet, etc., it makes a lot of sense and is worth reading. So, you know, I think we have to measure the cacophony of voices we're hearing now that Corona is moving quickly to the number one issue in the mainstream media and in a lot of the alternative or new media. It's out there now. And look what it is. Look at the effect it's had on the economy. In the last week, the stock market, Wall Street, losing more value in stocks, $2 trillion worth. You have to go back to 2008 and the fall crash of the markets and the economy there, which helped to elect Barack Hussein Obama, to find a similar point. And of course, yes, plunging stocks. Here we go, John Rappaport again. One of his articles titled "Plunging Stocks, Pandemic Fears, Quarantines, What's the Real Operation?" Right. I mean, so much of the establishment, that's an easy term, one word to refer to it all, the deep state, the administrative state, the Democrats, the establishment want to take down Donald Trump. And everything they have tried so far has failed, and they keep trying new things, new strategies. Well, here's one that looks like it's already had an impact. It's really seriously hit the economy. And you know, they now have their method. By the way, I'm just seeing breaking news that here another domino is falling. Senator Amy Klobuchar has announced that she's ending her campaign for president today, thank God. And she is endorsing, guess who? Joe Biden in Dallas this evening. That is Monday, March 2nd, 2020, as we speak, in advance of Super Tuesday tomorrow. So the, you know, who's next, I guess we can ask. I mean, I guess it looks now like to not shift too radically to back to politics, but it looks now that the Democrat race will be, from here on out, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and for as long as he can last, Mike Bloomberg. And Bloomberg can probably hold on for a long while because he's worth, $70 billion. So it's a drop in the bucket to him. And, of course, we shouldn't leave out Elizabeth Warren, but it would not surprise me if Senator Warren is the next one to drop out, although will she endorse Bernie or Joe Biden? I mean, you know, this is an interesting time in American political history, and I just wish that I almost wish I was like a citizen of another country, but working here as a journalist so I could cover it without feeling like there's a knife at my throat if the American voters, people who vote here, make the wrong decision in November. And you could kind of look at it more clinically and dispassionately. But really, as much as you analyze it, in the back of your mind is the fact that if any of these characters, any of the ones left, or as I've said, any who may emerge, you know, look out, because it will be hell to pay. Now, just in the closing moments, I just wanted to touch briefly on a couple of things today. We have the Israeli election today, and will Bibi Netanyahu survive his latest challenge there? Well, the results are coming in. There's some good news on the cable news front for those who actually respect Fox News. Fox News is reporting its highest ratings in the 24-year history of the cable news channel. And one way of interpreting this, in my opinion, is that supporters of Donald Trump and potential, that is, people interested in the alternative to the Democrats, are going to Fox News because they know they're going to get a more fair and objective story there, if not pro-conservative, which is obviously the case for much of the broadcast day at Fox News. So it's almost like a big national exit poll or focus group on media, and Fox News is eclipsing MSNBC and CNN in particular, as well as the alphabet channels. And also, it'd be interesting to see if Chris Matthews of MSNBC, who has been on there forever with his program Hardball and is a political hack from way back, reminds me of an Irish Paul from Boston. He is half Irish, and I don't say that disparagingly. Some of my best friends are people of Irish descent. But, you know, he's kind of that Teddy Kennedy type, you know, this it's emerging that he is allegedly a sexist and a bully, and he's done some things recently. Actually, it might be three strikes and he's out. We shall see. Also, I wonder if any of you saw any of the coverage of President Trump's two-day trip to India last week. Most of the live coverage was on in the middle of the night U.S. time, which is prime time for me, so I got to see most of it, and it was just incredible. In particular, the rally that he headlined that was put on for him at the largest stadium, a soccer stadium, I believe it's the largest stadium in the world that seats about 125,000 people, and it was almost entirely full. And he gave a great speech there, as well as being introduced by the Indian premier. And it was just marvelous. But, of course, we still have the left and the media saying, well, our foreign affairs are in a shambles because President Trump has destroyed our relations with foreign countries, which is patently ridiculous. So what are we going to see in the days ahead? Well, we have the Super Tuesday primaries tomorrow, and then debates, more debates after that, and we'll see where the coronavirus goes. And just in closing here in the last minute or so, I want to thank Doug Hagman for letting me sit in for him today, and Tech Eric for doing, again, a marvelous job, as only he can do, in producing, technically producing and directing the program from back on the other coast. Thank you, Tech Eric. And, of course, I always want to thank the audience for this wonderful program. I really was so deeply touched by the comments at YouTube last week. And I'd like to mention, for those of you who do like to read, my one-page website, peter.media, so it's http://peter, P-E-T-E-R, dot media, M-E-D-I-A, that has links to all of my articles in American Thinker, or to an archive page there where all 200-plus of my articles can be read free in descending chronological order. And, oh, I didn't have a chance to talk about my coverage of Philip Haney, but please check out my most recent article there. It was part two on Philip Haney. I'm sorry I didn't get to that today. And it also has my Epoch Times article archive page link there. And my Twitter, which is pchowka, P-C-H-O-W-K-A, so twitter.com/pchowka. And I put out a call on that last week, and I gotten 70 or 80 new followers, and I think almost all of them have come from the guest hosting gig I did on the Hagman Report last Monday, the 24th. So thank you. And any of you who have a Twitter account, I'd really appreciate your just clicking on following me so I can continue to gain, quote, followers. I don't really like that term, but that's what they use. And if you don't have a Twitter account, you can still go there And that's where I announce to the world what I'm doing on the Barry Farber Show every week, usually on Wednesday nights, very occasionally on John B. Wells's Arc Midnight Saturday night show. I've been doing short news updates there, and maybe I'll be here again in the near future or the future too. I hope so. Thanks again, everyone. God bless you and God bless America and good night. This is Peter Barry Chalka signing off. Bye-bye.